today we're going to use a couple more, and the aim is going to be to compute the Hodge diamond of the quintic Flabial threefold. That's probably as far as I'll get today. And to do that, I'm going to have to just basically write down a couple more short exact sequences, and then we can start computing away with the cohomology groups that we need. So the first thing I need to do is to describe hypersurfaces. In CPN. So far, of course, the only cohomology groups that we computed were on CPN, and CPN is all very well. If you can do a mathematical physics problem on CPN, then it's the first thing to try. But most of the time in string theory, we're more interested in other manifolds, such as Calabi-Yau manifolds. So let's consider that we just have a single equation in the homogeneous coordinates of CPN, and we define the space in question as the set of zeros of that single equation. So let F on the Z be a homogeneous function of degree D, say, in CPB again. So F equals zero defines a smooth algebraic variety, which I'll call X, if F equals DF equals zero has no solution. So that's the so-called transversality condition. It's fairly easy to prove that if there are no solutions to F equals DF equals zero, which will generically be the case, by the way, then the hypersurface is going to be nice and smooth. So let's assume that that's the case. We've got a generic function F. Pardon? F equals zero, of course, has solutions on X. That's how I defined X. But I also want df equals zero to have no solutions on X. So you could paraphrase that as saying that df equals zero has no solutions on X. So what I want to do is to try and construct the sheaf of homogeneous functions on X. And I claim I can put it in a short exact sequence like this. So I want to consider a homogeneous function on X. Now, if you remembered, I could actually consider this OX as a sheaf on PN as well as a sheaf on X. It represents kind of the same thing in both cases. This is either as a sheaf on X, this is the sheaf of homogeneous functions on X, or as a sheaf on CPN, it's the sheaf of homogeneous functions, but only when I look at them restricted to X as a subspace of CPN. And I claim that if I take any function, any holomorphic function on X, that at least in a very small neighborhood, I can write it as a function over the whole of CPN. And don't forget, since I'm working with sheaves, all I need to care about is a very tiny little open neighborhood. So if you write any function in a little open neighborhood of X, I can write it as a function in the whole of CPN. So indeed, I have a surjective map from the space of functions on CPN to the space of functions on X. And this map, of course, is simply the restriction map. and that gives me a surjective map from this sheaf to this sheaf. So that's part of a short exact sequence. Now, of course, some functions might restrict to zero. So that's going to have to go in the left part of the short exact sequence. And of course, the function f itself is zero on x. And I claim that any function that vanishes on x must actually be f times something. If I take anything, any function, and multiply it by f, then it must vanish on x, because f vanishes on x. But I also claim the converse is true, that anything that does vanish on x must actually be f times something. So this map here is just multiplication by f. That will be the thing that's is guaranteed to compose with this to be zero, and also turn this into an exact sequence. The kernel of this map must be the image of this map. So I need to put something here. Well, this is going to look like functions again. I've got functions, but I'm multiplying by a function here, and it's a function of homogeneous degree d. And I said last time that if I have a map between two sheaves, which is multiplication by a function in homogeneous coordinates of degree d, then I've got to sort of have a difference in the amount I've twisted these sheaves by the degree of that. So f increases the degree by d. And this is degree zero, so this must be minus d. That's the only way globally that's going to make sense. So I claim this is a short exact sequence of the holomorphic functions in this twisted sheaf. I then multiply by f, gives me an obvious map to these functions. And the image of this map is precisely the kernel of the restriction of these functions to x itself. So this is a really important short exact sequence. Okay, if x is now let's look for a condition that x is a Calabi-Yau manifold. Of course, I haven't had any time to talk about Calabi-Yau manifolds, but they crop up a lot in string theory. For the purposes of these talks, all I'm going to say is that a Calabi-Yau manifold is the same thing as saying that. The top cohomology, so this is a n-fold. So this is a manifold of dimension n. Complex dimension n. Then the top cohomology of its sheaf of holomorphic functions is the complex numbers. And the converse is also true, actually. So X is a Calabi-Yau manifold if and only if this is true. This is almost certainly not the definition that you're used to, but it is equivalent to it. So let's check to see when this condition is true for a hypersurface of degree n, sorry, of degree d inside CP big N. So of course here, n is just equal to big N minus 1 because it's a hypersurface. So let's compute. Now, let me say immediately that it's kind of obvious from the definition of check cohomology that if I want to compute the nth cohomology group on X, it's actually the same thing as the nth cohomology group on the embedding space, Pn. Because all the sheaf cares about is the stuff on X. When I define the sheaf as a sheaf on Pn, it only ever did anything on X. So when I define my check cohomology and I start doing the calculations with the various patches and the intersection of patches. All I care about is x here, so I can equally replace that CPN by x. So that allows us, using this short exact sequence, to compute what this cohomology group is. So let me write it down like this. Let me do it here. Let me write it down again. I've got 0 goes to p, goes to o p m plus 1 minus d, goes to o p m plus 1, goes to ox. I have to make sure my zeros don't look like curly O's. The standard problem. So now I write down the associated long exact sequence to this. And let me write it down this, like this. Let me do a row here which corresponds to H0. So we said what the cohomology groups of these sheaves on CPN were last time. And I get 0 there, and the complex numbers there. And of course, this is what I want to compute. H1 is 0, 0. And then everything is 0 from then on until I get down to Hn, which is also 0. And then Hn plus 1. Well, the top cohomology group at CPN plus 1, twisted by a negative number, could be non-zero. I'll put C, D minus 1, N plus. If you look back at the notes from last time, that's what we computed it as, and there's a 0. So I know that I have a long exact sequence going across the blackboard like this. Which means that I can immediately fill in what these question marks, because I know it's a long exact sequence. The only thing that can go there to make it a long exact sequence is the complex numbers. The only thing that can go there is 0. The only thing that can go here in Hn is C, D minus 1, N plus 4. And then that's 0. So here's Hn. So I've proven that Hn of x, Ox, is c to the d minus 1, n plus 4. It's a long exact sequence. It starts here, then it goes to there, then it wraps around again. That's the long exact sequence. It snakes around all the way down to the bottom. So x is a Calabi-Yau if and only if D equals N plus 2. Because that's the only time that this binomial coefficient is going to be equal to 1. Well, it's the positive numbers, anyway, so it makes sense. So you can quickly draw a table of what the Calabi-Yaus are in various dimensions. A one-dimensional Calabi-Yau, I'd need a cubic equation inside CP2, and this, of course, is what's called an elliptic curve. Or I could have a degree 4 equation in CP3, and this is called a K3 surface. Or in dimension 3, I can get a Calabi-Yau threefold by looking at the quintic, the equation of degree 5 in CP4, and this is called the quintic threefold. So let's focus on this one, and if I have time, I might come back and do the same computation for the K3 surface. It's quite interesting in that case. So let's compute all the Hodge numbers of the quintic threefold. So in order to compute the Hodge numbers, I need to compute the qth cohomology of the P3 complete exterior power of the cotangent bundle. So I need to get my hands on the cotangent bundle of x. Let me put a subscript x just to emphasize it's the cotangent bundle of x. Now it turns out I'll be able to phrase things in terms of the tangent bundle of x rather than the cotangent bundle of x. I'll explain that shortly. So let's think, how can we get the tangent bundle of x? Well, I can write down another short exact sequence which relates the tangent bundle, or tangent sheaf, I should say, of x to the tangent sheaf of the embedding CPN. So I claim that there is a thing called the adjunction formula. Which says the following. Well, if I consider the tangent sheaf of x, it's clearly a subsheaf of the tangent sheaf of the whole of CPN. And from now on, just to save my notation a bit, I'm going to just write W instead of CPV again. So x is a subspace of W. Well, if x is a subspace of W, then the tangent directions on x are obviously a subspace of the tangent directions on the whole of the space that it's embedded in. That's the same thing as saying that there's an injective map from the tangent sheaf of x to the tangent sheaf of W restricted to x. This notation here means restrict to. So just take the tangent sheaf as a sheaf on W, but think of it as a sheaf on x, just by simply just focusing on the x part of it. So these are all the possible tangent directions inside W. These are the tangent directions of x. What's left over must be the normal directions. So let me put a curly N. This is the normal sheaf. Of x and cyclic. And then if you look at the local coordinate patches, it's not a difficult exercise to actually discover what this normal sheaf is. Obviously it must correspond to a one-dimensional bundle on x, because the dimension of this is one less than the dimension of this. So I must have a one-dimensional normal bundle. I've got a sheaf of sections of a one-dimensional normal bundle. And of course, all the one-dimensional the line bundles all look something like O of something. So I must have an O of something, which goes in this position here. And just by writing down explicit coordinates, it would take me way too long to do it on the blackboard. It's a rather tedious but straightforward exercise to show that actually what it is this. So in our case of the quintic, this is O5. And to be pedantic, this is this is a line bundle on W, which again I've restricted to X. And this is 5 precisely because I'm looking at equations of degree 5. So this is the other short exact sequence I need. So I've got 3 short exact sequences. I've got the one I wrote down yesterday, I'm sure I'll write down again shortly, for the tangent sheaf. I've got this, which tells me how to write down sheaves on X in terms of sheaves on CPN. And I've got this, which relates the tangent sheaf of X to the tangent sheaf of CPN. Right, this is a sheaf on X. That's right, so that's why I've had to restrict this sheaf, which is on W, to being a sheaf on X. But the easiest way to prove this is just to look at little patches. I mean, it's easy enough to write explicitly down what these what a basis for the tangent directions are in terms of the homogeneous coordinates. And you can see that the normal directions are going to be something to do with degree 5 polynomials. So that's why there's a 5. Pardon? There's no metric involved. All I need to... I just need to construct the quotient space. I mean, I don't need to consider... a metric would give me some notion of the normal bundle being a subspace of this. But I just need to construct this as a quotient space of this divided by that. So I don't need to mention any metric. Okay, so one last thing I need to claim, and then we can compute away to find what the Hodge numbers are. So on a Calabi-Yau manifold, the highest exterior power. So again, this is a dimension n. I'm sorry to have to quote these results at you again. The highest exterior power of the tangent bundle is a trivial line bundle. Now, this immediately implies. So this, of course, well, I'm going to get kind of mixing up sheaves and bundles a bit here. What I called omega n would be the sheaf of sections of this bundle. What this does is that this implies that that there's a pairing, which means that the dth, well, let me call it p rather than the pth exterior power of the tangent sheaf is naturally isomorphic to the n minus d exterior power of the cotangent sheaf, which of course is the same thing as omega n. So because of this special property of the highest exterior power of the cotangent bundle, I can map the exterior powers of the tangent sheaf can be mapped into exterior powers of the cotangent sheaf. And that's going to make life a little bit easier for me. I don't really need to use this, but it makes the computation a little bit easier to follow. But it means that when I'm computing the Hodge numbers, the exterior powers of the cotangent sheaf I can replace by exterior powers of the tangent sheaf. Well, yeah, it's just the natural pairing that I have between exterior powers. The fact that the top exterior power is trivial means that there's a natural pairing between p forms and n minus p forms. Okay. So off we go. I've got all the ingredients I need now. Well, the first Hodge numbers, of course, I can compute h. I'll put h star for h anything of x. No, let me put q there. So the dimension of those we can already compute. This is h 0 q. And we've already computed those numbers. That's exactly what we computed here. So this means that h 0 0 is 1, h 1 0 is 0, h 2 0 is 0, all the way down to h n 0, which is 1. So we've already done that. So let's do the next column. And that's actually all we need to do is to do the next computation. So now consider h q of x in the tangent sheaf. So let's compute the cohomology groups of the tangent sheaf And from what I've just said there, this will immediately give us the Hodge numbers of the, some of the Hodge numbers, because this is the same thing as omega 2 of x, since I'm on a threefold. So the dimension of these are going to give us the Hodge numbers 2 comma q, h2 comma q. Okay, so let's see if I can be organized about this. If I'm not careful, I'll make a big mess on the blackboard. So what we want, I want, of course, to use, I need the cohomology of the tangent sheaf, so I therefore I need to use this short exact sequence to relate the cohomology of the tangent sheaf to the cohomology of this sheaf and this sheaf. So I need to compute before that the cohomologies of the cohomology of this sheaf and the cohomology of this sheaf. So let's start with this one first. Of O, X, R. Well, I called it O, W, 5, X. But that is exactly the same thing as O, X, 5. So let's do that. Well, I had a short exact sequence, which I just erased from over there, which said that O W minus 5 goes to O W goes to zero. And I can just twist all of these sheaves by a thing of degree 5 to rewrite this as that. This is equally a short exact sequence with a minus 5 there and a 0 there and a 0 there. I can just twist all the sheaves by OW of 5 to make this a short exact sequence. And now I can compute the cohomology in the same way as I did on the right-hand blackboard. So H0, well, the zeroth cohomology of OW, where W is CP4, is the complex numbers. H0 of OW twisted by 5 turns out to be C to the 126. So that must be 9, so 9 choose 5 must be 126. So that goes to something. And then all the other cohomology groups are 0. So that allows me to fill in this column. Well, I had a zero here. So I've got a short exact sequence. Zero goes to C 126, goes to something, goes to zero. So that's a short exact sequence. I've just got three non-trivial elements, there, there, and there. So this must be the quotient of that divided by that, which is C to the 125. And all the others have to be zero. So this tells me, therefore, and let me phrase it like this, the cohomology of x of O x 5 equals, and let me just list them separately by column, by commas. C 125 is the zeroth cohomology, zero is the first cohomology, zero is the second cohomology. And they're all zero. So that's the cohomology of OX5. We had, I think, that the dimension we had C to the H0 of PN OD, I think, is C to the N plus D choose D. Right, follow me closing, right. So it's 9 choose 4. 5. That's the same thing. Hopefully it's 126. So I've done OX5. So I've done this guy. So next I've got to do this guy. TW. Well, to do TW, well, this isn't TW, this is TW restricted to X. Well, how can I find the cohomology of TW restricted to X? Well, again, I can take this this short exact sequence that I just had. And what I want to do is I want to tensor this by the tangent sheaf TW. Remember, I could take the tensor product of sheaves. What I get from that is 0 goes to the tangent sheaf of W twisted by minus 5. That's the definition of that notation. TW minus 5 just means like I take the tensor product of TW with O of minus 5. This, of course, is TW. And I claim that if I take the tensor product of the tangent sheaf of W by functions which just live on X, then what I get is the tangent sheaf of W restricted to X. I get exactly what I need. Tensoring by this does the restriction. So that means that I can compute the cohomology of this if I know the cohomology of this and the cohomology of this. So I need to work harder now. I need to compute the cohomology groups of that, and I need to compute the cohomology groups of that. Well, the cohomology groups of this I did last time. H star of W, tangent sheaf of W. I gave you the numbers last time. It's C to the 24, and then all the others are 0. Again, that's a simple thing to compute. So now I now need the cohomology of TW minus 5. Well, let me do that explicitly. I've got enough time. So let's go back to the Euler exact sequence that we've had. Should I get it right? Yeah, here we go. So if you remember, the way that I computed this was I used the so-called Euler exact sequence of sheaves, which says that 0 goes to O, goes to O of W, O of W 1 to the 5th, because W is CP4, goes to the tangent sheaf of W. That was my Euler exact sequence for CP4. But I want to compute it twisted by minus 5. So I can put a minus 5 in here. I can replace that 1 with a minus 4. And I can put a minus 5 in. So that's a short exact sequence. Let me compute the cohomology of these groups. Actually, let me make sure I'm going to do them all, H3 and H4. So if you look back at our results for the cohomology of these listed sheaves on CPN, I get 0 for H0, 0 for H1, 0 for H2, 0 for H3, and the fourth cohomology of O minus 5 is C. The cohomology of these all vanish. So that now lets me compute what the last column is from the fact that I have a long exact sequence. So obviously I get 0, 0, 0, so 0, 1, 2, and then the third cohomology has to be C. That's going to match the back going. The state match going now. So, cohomology of W, 255 minus 5, is 0, 0, 2, and then in the third cohomology group I have C. So that lets me compute the restriction to X. So now I want to use this short exact sequence. Let me copy it up to the top of the board again. So I can write down my cohomology groups under it. So H0, H1, H2, H3. So minus 5 gives me 0, 0, 0, C. W gives me C to the 24. 0, 0, 0, 0. So for my long exact sequence, I get C to the 24, 0, 0, no, C, 0, 0. So the cohomology on X, or W, it makes no difference, TW restricted to X, is C to the 24, 0, C, it's got a second cohomology group, 0, 0, 0, 0. So, we're almost done. We can go back to the so the earlier short exact sequence, which said that 0 goes to the tangent sheaf of X, goes to the tangent sheaf of X restricted to W, goes to O of 5, goes to 0. So we're there at last. I can now compute what the cohomology groups of T of X are, which is what I wanted. So here we have C to the 24, 0, C, 0, 0, indeed. Here I have C to the 125, 0, 0, 0, 0. And I have a question mark here and a question mark here. Now at this point, just from the long exact sequencing alone, I don't quite have enough information to fill in this map and this map. Sorry, this group and this group, because I need to know details about this map. I know that whatever goes here must be the kernel of that group mapping into that group. Because I've got 0 goes to something, goes to C to the 24, goes to C to the 125. So this must correspond to the kernel of that map. And similarly, this thing must correspond to the co-kernel of this map. This must be whatever this divided by the image of that is. So at the moment, I haven't explicitly told you what that map is, so I don't know how to fill in this thing here and this thing here. There are two ways around this problem. The first is to explicitly work out what this map is. as a general rule, if you're in H0, H0 comes from global sections. And you know what the global sections are. You can explicitly write down global sections in terms of homogeneous coordinates. So I can write down what the global sections of this look like, what the global sections of that look like, and work out explicitly what this map is. And that's not very hard to do. I should warn you that this is only practical for H0. For H0, we've got global sections. You can write things down explicitly. For the H1s and H2s, etc., you'd have to be a complete masochist to work out explicitly what the map is in terms of Czech cohomology. But for H0, it's fairly practical to explicitly work out what this map is. And you can prove that this is an injective map. So if that map is injective, you immediately know that that must be 0, and this must be C to the 101. This is unambiguously C, the rest is 0. Let me tell you the other way of working out what this is, and in some sense, this second way is easier. We can prove directly what this group is. I can just prove that it must be 0 in the following way. So what we're looking for, of course, is H0 of Tx. So the dimension of H0 Tx. Well, I've already said I can replace the tangent sheaf by the second exterior power of the cotangent sheaf, thanks to the Calabi-Yau property. But this, of course, is precisely the Hodge number H20 by definition. And now I can use the property of a Kähler manifold, which tells me that H20 is H02, which is the dimension of the second cohomology of X LX. And we've already computed this group. We computed this group at the very start of the talk, and we discovered it was 0. So I can use the Kähler property to turn PQ Hodge numbers into QP Hodge numbers, and turn this computation into another computation which we've already done. So that tells me that this is 0, which therefore tells me that this is an injective map, which therefore tells me that that's C to the 101. So, we're done. We've got the whole Hodge diamond. So what is the Hodge diamond? Well, I've got 1, 0, 0, 1. That's what we already knew from the earlier computation that we did. Now, so what are these Hodge numbers? Well, so H, what's this? This is H21, I claim. H21 is the dimension of the first cohomology of the second exterior power of the cotangent, which is the same thing as the first cohomology of the tangent sheaf, which we've just computed. It's 101. So therefore I have 101 here, and I have 101 here, by the symmetry of the Hodge diamond. And then I've also got this number here, C, H22 is the dimension of H2 of X, and the 2, which is the dimension of H2 of X Tx, therefore it's 1. So I've got a 1 there, and therefore by symmetry I've got a 1. So there's the full Hodge diamond. These are all the Hodge numbers. Of the proof. Okay. Now, if you're if you're experienced in computing Hodge numbers, you'll know that in this case, there are easier ways of calculating the Hodge numbers that I just used. You can use index theorems and chain classes and Lefschetz hyperplane theorems and arrive at these numbers in a faster way. But I think it's well worth going through this exercise that we've just done, because it teaches you the more general method, which can always be used, even when you can't use these other special cases of things like Lefschetz hyperplane theorem. So this is still a very useful computation. Now let me give a couple of interpretations of the result that we just have. Oh, let me keep this. And I've erased half of it. The first thing I want to claim is that this 101 is a useful number in its own right, as well as just being a Hodge number, because it counts the number of deformations of complex structure. So what I'm about to say is true in generality, not just for Calabi-Yau manifolds. So suppose I give you a manifold with a complex structure, and I want to somehow consider deformations of that complex structure. So the complex structure, of course, was a thing that acted on the cotangent bundle that we called J mu nu, and this satisfies the fact that it squares to minus one. And in order to be a complex structure, not just an almost complex structure, there is this messy thing called the Nienhaus tensor, which had to vanish. And in complex coordinates, we could write out explicitly that jk is minus I delta ijk, j bar k bar equals minus I delta j bar k bar. And the last components, jk bar and j bar k, with zero. So that was explicitly what the complex structure looked like, inside these commas. If we had complex coordinates. So suppose we have a complex manifold with complex coordinates. We begin with this complex structure, and now we try and deform it slightly. Oh, you think there should be a 2 there? Oh, sorry, yeah, you're absolutely right. I should have a minus there. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I have the opposite sign for the holomorphic and the anti-holomorphic ones. Thanks. So, suppose we do a deformation. So I have some small, in some sense, deformation of my complex structure that I'll call tau. Then the first thing I can say, so that's going to be tau, but I'm going to use the complex coordinates that I have. You've given me a complex manifold with complex coordinates, so I'll use this as my complex structure. And now I'll deform it slightly, but using the same coordinates. Well, first of all, I want to maintain that j squared is minus one. And if I run through this, it immediately tells me this tau jk equals tau j prime k prime is zero. That must be true, at least at first order, if this is a very small deformation of that. So all I need to care about is tau j k prime and tau j prime k, but that turns out to be the complex conjugate of tau j k prime. So let tau, without any indices, equal tau j k prime k bar dz k bar d by dz. So I'm defining a one form with values in the tangent bundle, or to be more precise, I'm defining a zero one form with values in the holomorphic tangent. A 0, 1 form in the tangent bundle or sheaf, whatever you want to call it, bundle in this context. Well, it's then easy to prove, but of course a little messy because it involves the Nienhaus tensor, that the condition that the Nienhaus tensor vanishes is equivalent to this tau being killed by d-bar. So that's the condition that our new complex structure is not just an almost complex structure that can be integrated up to a full complex structure. So it must be d-bar closed. Furthermore, if our tau is equal to d-bar of something, let's call it v, the sum V, where V, of course, is going to be a zero form valued in the tangent bundle, then this complex structure, this changing complex structure, is equivalent to a change of coordinates, a holomorphic change of form. Basically, Zj is replaced by Zj plus Vj. I can put a superscript j here because this V is still valued in the tangent bundle. So this corresponds to a holomorphic change of coordinates. So in some sense, this is trivial. Complex structure. So what I've proved, of course, is the first order for infinitesimal variations of complex structure, I find that the deformations are given by the cohomology group. The deformation of complex structure to first order, we just did an approximation where we said that tau is very, very much smaller than j, and then we just expanded things to first order, given by the first cohomology group of, that is v bar. Well, let me just go straight to check cohomology of T. We're valued in the tangent bundle, so I can replace that by the tangent sheaf, and we're looking at 0-1 forms. And of course, those in terms of Dalbo cohomology could be rewritten in terms of sheaf cohomology, so this is H1. So this group, this first cohomology group of X with values in the tangent bundle or tangent sheaf, gives me the deformations of complex structure, at least the first order. Now, it turns out for a Calabi-Yau manifold, all first order deformations are true deformations. That's not true in general. For a more generic manifold, you could find that there's a first order deformation, but it's kind of abstracted at higher order, so it doesn't give me a true deformation. But in the case of Calabi-Yau manifolds, any first order deformation can be, you can deform it by a finite non-zero amount, and it really is a deformation. So coming back to what we did in the quintic, I erased it. Fantastic. Coming back to the quintic, this means that we've proven that there are 101 deformations of complex structure. So I have to write this down again. I have the title sheet. Right, H0, which was zero. C to the 24, C to the 125, C to the 101. So here we are. The first cohomology group of the tangent sheaf is 101 dimensional. So there are 101 deformations of complex sheaf. Now, in this case, you can see how this works in another way, which is a trick that's commonly used, especially in the physics literature. In some sense, there is a simpler way that I could have got at this 101, which is kind of manifest from this short exact sequence. If I give you a quintic threefold, and I ask you how you can deform it, well, one of the obvious ways of deforming a quintic threefold is to deform the quintic equation that's been used to define that threefold. I could define my threefold as z0 to the fifth plus z1 to the fifth plus z2 to the fifth plus dot, 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 and then plus 56.5 times z0 to the cubed, z4, z5, plus something times z0, z1, z2, z3, z4. I could write down all possible degree 5 terms, and I could vary the coefficients in terms of those terms. That will deform my Calabi-Yau threefold, and actually will give me a deformation of complex structure. Well, how many such deformations could there be? Well, the first thing you would ask is, how many possible terms are there in a general quintic? Well, there are 126 terms. One of the ways that you deform this is manifestly trivial, because it would be just equivalent to rescaling the homogeneous coordinates, which I know is trivial on CP4. So let's subtract 1, because it just corresponds to the obvious rescaling of the coordinates. So in some sense, there are 125 deformations of the polynomial. But of those 125 deformations, some of them will correspond to a linear change in the homogeneous coordinates, which is like a GL5C transformation. Although, since we're in projective space, I call it PGL5C, so I'll take out the trivial rescaling. So there's an obvious reparametrization invariance, which is 24 dimensions, and if I subtract those from 125, I get 101. So there are 101 deformations of the polynomial, which correspond to a deformation of complex structure. And that's exactly what this short exact sequence is telling us. This 125 here are sections of OX5, which are precisely polynomials that look like this, modulo the trivial rescaling. And the sections of this, can be argued, are exactly this PGL5C. So in this case, the deformations are exactly the polynomial deformations. These are therefore called polynomial deformations. but you should beware, this doesn't always happen. So I shall just close quickly, just in the last couple of minutes, with what would happen in exactly the same computation for a K3 surface, so one dimension lower, and we'll see it doesn't quite work out in the same way. And this is a general fact that not all polynomial not all deformations of complex structure are necessarily polynomial deformations, and actually vice versa. Sometimes polynomial deformations can somehow be obstructed, or be trivial in some sense. So let's write down the same thing for the quartic. So now W is CP3, and X is the K3 surface, which is degree 4. And I'll just write down what the corresponding numbers are here. What we find is that we get C to the 15, C 0. Here I get C to the 34, 0, 0. So now I need to fill in this column to find out what my Hodge numbers are. And again, for exactly the same reason as in the quintic, I got a 0 here, I also get a 0 in the K3 surface. And now, well, I've got C15 goes to C35 goes to something goes to C. The dimension of this must therefore be 1 plus 34 minus 15, which is 20. That must be a C20. To make that exact. And then this must be a 0. So we've got C20. So the dimension of H1 of a K3 surface with values in the tangent sheaf is 20. So there are 20 deformations of complex structure. However, the number of deformations of the polynomial is 34 minus 15. Of the quartic equation. So this last thing was just to prove that these long exact sequences can prove non-trivial results. This is the rigorous proof that there are 20 deformations of the complex structure of the K3 surface. Whereas if I was naive and just tried to count it from deformations of the defining equation, I'd just get 19. So I shall stop there. Thank you.
Really great. No, you hadn't been planning. Thanks for the offer. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Pretty good.